Coming up on Weekend America.
When is a weekend shift at the factory like giving birth?
The life of a board, the life of a circuit board. It's a little baby getting ready to toddle, getting ready to waddle.
If you're going to work weekends, it's good to love your work. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Also this hour, when you fall in love with a bear named Squirty, the people around you are going to have to suffer.
The hierarchy goes Squirty, then me, and then the rest of our family.
I get bit for bringing people like you in.
Oh, I'm sorry, Bill.
And what do you do when the weekend doesn't seem weekendy enough?
Oh, there's too many people walking without a tear in their head. You're on vacation, people!
Okay, we'll try to get folks to relax at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival on Weekend America after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, Minnesota.
And I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles, home to many Cinco de Mayo celebrations this weekend. Louisville is alive with the Kentucky Derby. It's also World Naked Gardening Day, so later this hour we'll dig the joys of pruning without clothing. What are you planting in your garden?
This year in my garden, I am going to grow pumpkins.
I do not plant in my garden. That's my father's job. He does all the planting, and he plants perennials.
I usually go down and plant in the garden with my grandpa, and it's tradition. We always put corn in the garden.
I wanted to plant, like, about a week ago, start some seeds, and I was going to plant marigolds because they're easy and pretty.
Why plant tomatoes and peppers? Because it doesn't take a lot of space. I like the tomatoes for my sandwiches, and my wife likes to fix stuffed peppers.
You know, I could never get pumpkins to grow in my garden. Maybe I should try it with no clothes on.
We'll hear more about that idea a little bit later. Those voices came from St. Louis, Charleston, West Virginia, and Fairbanks, Alaska.
Well, we begin the show today by bringing you a story about people who work on the weekend. It's part of our series, Weekend Shift. For this installment, a mystery. It starts one weekend last September when a young man was working late in his job in Silicon Valley. Now, we know lots of jobs in Silicon Valley require putting in some extra time on the weekends. Whether you're a CEO of a new startup or a self-taught web designer or a software developer with a degree from MIT. But this young man was working on the other end of the industry, the manufacturing end. On that fateful Saturday, he was at a factory making circuit boards, the kind of boards that power pretty much every gadget that you own. Weekend America's Chrissy Clark takes it from here.
This mystery begins in my purse, which is where my cell phone is right now, somewhere. And the mystery begins wherever your cell phone is right now, too.
Hello?
Once you find it, pry off the phone's plastic casing. You don't really have to do this, just imagine it. And if you break the phone apart, inside you'll find the brains of your phone, or any electronic device, attached to what's called a printed circuit board. A green board with a complicated pattern of thin copper lines that determine the path that an electric current will take. This intricate board looks like it sprang into the world fully formed. But it was actually made somewhere by human beings in a factory like this.
Well, as you can see, I mean, you know, a factory in manufacturing isn't glamorous.
Laura Boozer is the chief operating officer of this factory called Coastal Circuits. She's showing me around a drab trailer and low-slung warehouse just off the freeway in Redwood City, south of San Francisco. In the late 1980s, this area was home to at least 100 shops like this, supplying the raw materials for the Silicon Valley tech boom. Now, most circuit boards come from China, where they're cheaper, but a few stateside factories have managed to hang on.
One of the things that makes us a unique niche is we're quick turn.
Boozer explains that when local tech companies develop a new gadget, say a new GPS system or medical device, they need to test their design with a prototype before they mass produce it overseas. The circuit boards for those prototypes are made here. Even though they're more expensive, they're available quick.
When a customer needs something in 3 days, we really have to move and push work through different shifts in order to get that accomplished. That's how we have a competitive edge over our offshore counterparts.
Which is why the factory runs 24 hours a day during the week and often stays open late for rush jobs on the weekends.
Do you have your safety glasses?
Kathy Bergman supervises the 80 or so employees who work the assembly lines at the factory. She takes me into a giant room with rows of small tanks. Some are filled with water rinses. Some of them bubble with different colored corrosive liquids, phosphoric acid, sodium hydroxide, sulfuric acid. They give off an acrid smell.
We got a bubbling blue liquid here.
This is like copper itself.
This is the plating shop.
So Luis is grabbing that order.
A man named Jose Luis takes the fiberglass cores of several circuit boards and dips them into a series of chemical solutions to coat them with a thin layer of conductive metal.
How long have you been working here?
Almost 30 years in the circuit boards.
Almost 30 years?
Six different companies.
And where are you from?
From Mexico.
Mexico?
Most of the workers here are from Mexico. Most of the supervisors are white, like Kathy Bergman. She has a Spanish tutor, so she can communicate better with her staff. That's especially important in a place like this, filled with open tanks of hazardous chemicals.
Would these be dangerous to put your hand in? I mean,
absolutely. Yeah. Our operators wear mandiles, which is an apron.
That's a Spanish word.
Yeah, I always tell them, put on your mandil. They wear safety glasses. When they're dipping the boards in the tanks, they wear face shields. They wear chemical-resistant boots, they wear long sleeves, and they wear gloves. So, back in here.
On our way out of the plating room, something catches my eye.
Now, what's this?
Tucked into a corner of the room by the door. A framed photo of a young man with dark hair, smiling. Someone has arranged silk flowers around it.
This is just a picture of an employee. So, this is the...
On September 23rd, 2007, a young man named Fernando Gonzalez was found dead at his workplace.
Fernando Gonzalez was the man memorialized in that picture in the factory. He was 18 years old, a worker on the plating line at Coastal Circuits, according to John Wilson, the deputy district attorney for San Mateo County, where Gonzalez died. The DA's office is still in the middle of investigating the case. But the California Division of Occupational Safety and Health, nicknamed Cal OSHA, already concluded its investigation. Scott McAllister headed it up, with very little evidence to work with, because Fernando Gonzalez was working alone at the factory the night that he died, on a special shift. When he still wasn't home at 1 a.m, his family got worried.
Fernando Gonzalez's father had come to Coastal Circuits, the shop where they both worked, and found his son in a rinse tank on the plating line, having probably drowned, and he was dead.
The father told authorities he'd found his son wedged into a small tank, upside down. The autopsy revealed no signs of foul play, drugs, or death from natural causes. It did reveal faint traces of sulfuric acid in Gonzalez's blood. There was an early theory that fumes from one of the chemical compounds on the plating line overcame Gonzalez, made him pass out into a tank. But McAllister tried to recreate the environment that night, based on interviews with other workers, and he found nothing to suggest that's what happened.
We sampled the person who did Fernando's job, pretty much exactly as he was doing it the night that he died. And we found the exposures were very, very slight.
There were a few clear work safety violations on the night Gonzalez died. They amounted to $3,800 in fines for Coastal Circuits. The factory has since appealed them. McAllister says based on the little evidence he has, there's nothing the employer did or didn't do that he can point to and say, if that had been different, Fernando Gonzalez would still be alive. That was hard to explain to Gonzalez's family.
I was the guy who had to bring Fernando's clothes back to his uncle, and he asked me, you know, what do you know? You know, did you know something? Did you find out something? And I had to say, no, I don't know anything. I don't have any answers for you. I'm sorry. I just have his clothes. That was it.
Is this the room that he died in?
Yes.
The people who used to work with Fernando Gonzalez don't talk about the mystery much. Company officials wouldn't let me speak with his family or any of his co-workers about the case, and repeated attempts to contact the family outside of the factory were unsuccessful. Kathy Bergman, the supervisor at Coastal Circuits, says right after the accident, the company brought in counselors to help workers deal with their grief. Not just Gonzalez's father, but two uncles and a sister all work at the factory, too. The operation closed for a few days for the investigators to inspect things, but then they all got back to work. Bergman says the workers wanted to go back. They needed the money.
This is what we do. You know, this is our life. This is what everybody knows how to do. And you know, it was a terrible, terrible blow, but you know, we have to go on. You know, we love each other. We got through it together, and we're going forward.
It's likely that no one will ever know exactly how or why Fernando Gonzalez died when he was 18 years old. That mystery will remain unsolved. But that's only one of the mysteries that this story is about. There is another, bigger mystery to this story. The mystery of who makes the electronic parts that power our cell phones and iPods and pacemakers in the first place. When we get these devices fully assembled and shiny and new, they seem to be magic, and they seem to come from some magical place. But they come from a real place, sometimes far away in China, sometimes right here in the U.S., off a freeway. A place that smells bad, that is full of potentially dangerous chemicals, a place where young men and their fathers and uncles and sisters go to work every day.
Hey, Charlie.
In Redwood City, California.
How are you doing?
I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
Charlie? And what are you doing here?
I'm doing a drill and a second drill.
You're the second drill? So tell us what you need, what this is for.
What I'm going to do is drill the second drill for the...
The DA's Work Safety Division is still investigating Fernando's death to see if any charges will be brought. Special thanks to playwright Maya Garantz, who helped with this piece. Her play, Clean, looks at Fernando's story and at the social geography of Silicon Valley.
We don't often think about the toxic chemicals that go into our electronics. I understand that Santa Clara County in Silicon Valley has the nation's highest concentration of Superfund sites, the sites that are so toxic the government has to clean them up.
You know, you usually don't think of those kinds of sites being in somewhere like Silicon Valley. You think of them in older industrial cities. Well, California is now starting a green chemistry initiative. Instead of focusing on disposing of or incinerating industrial waste, they want to start making electronic goods in the first place using less toxic materials, less energy, and creating less waste. For more information, you can go to our website at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat.
Coming up, you need to teach your child to accept herself. And if you don't, you're rotten. The mixed messages of parenting next on Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. My weekends are dominated by being a first-time father of a toddler. I've been doing a monthly series about the values I hope to pass on to my daughter, who's now turning 15 months old. Last month, you may recall, I was talking to Washington Post human behavior writer Shankar Vedantam about what we teach our children, and he made an important point.
I'm not sure it's the things you actually convey through your words that impart the most valuable lessons to your children. Most of the important things you communicate are not going to be communicated through your words, but through your actions.
My daughter isn't talking, but she's watching her parents closely and drawing her mental map of the world based on her life at home. Today, I want to find out what that map looks like. What information am I giving my daughter? Are all of us giving our children without even knowing it? I asked clinical psychologist Mary Jane Rothrum to pay me a home visit. Rothrum directs the Global Center for Children and Families at UCLA. The center is trying to convince parents to have these home visits regularly instead of waiting for problems to come up. Dr. Rothrum came to my house and sat down with me, my daughter Susanna, and my wife Sarah in our family room. She told us she wanted to know what our values are and whether we're living according to them.
So then I'd say, Sarah, what is the most important gift you want to give your daughter?
The first thing that came to mind was, it sounds kind of cliche, but self-love. If she could grow up loving herself and being happy inside, I would feel like we succeeded as parents.
Mary Jane asked me the same thing on the phone when we first talked, and that was, I think, the first thing I said as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yes. And it's so important that you both said the same thing. Had you talked about it before?
No, not at all.
Okay, so far so good. We both want Susanna to love herself as she is. The next question, do we actually treat her that way?
So tell me, what happens in the morning at your house?
Bill and I get up and start getting ourselves ready, and about 45 minutes after I get up, I start to hear, you know, the crib rattle, or I hear her start to cry or start to talk to herself. And I go up and I say, "Hi, Susanna," and she always has a big smile, and she grabs her little snuggly, her little lovey.
And, it's a little crib toy.
Yeah, and I pick her up and we sit in the glider together and I talk to her a bit and she nurses and we just stay there for as long as she needs to kind of to wake up and to snuggle and, you know, welcome the day together.
And that kind of consistent positive routine has been linked to long-term healthy families, not only in the United States, but in France, in Switzerland, in Africa, in Japan, in Vietnam.
Why? Why is routine so important?
We are creatures of habit. It helps them learn at your daughter's age, which is 15 months, she already knows how to soothe herself. She has something that when you're not there, she can hold on to. You have it every morning when she wakes up.
Man, this was going really well. She questioned us for more than an hour. She watched Susanna interacting, and she told us our daughter is thriving, and we are communicating our value of self-love. In fact, she was so positive that I didn't completely buy it. I mean, every upbringing has its downsides, right? I wish Susanna could live at the edge of a forest. What values are we communicating with all the concrete and pavement around her? And she's got no cousins or grandparents nearby. What does that communicate about family? And here's the big one. Susanna spends 4 days a week with a nanny while her parents work. What does that say to her?
There's no downsides of spending time in childcare when it's good childcare. In fact, there appears to be a benefit. When you have working parents, it forces children to take more responsibility.
You're not just being polite. I mean, really, no part of you says, oh, parents are farming out their parenting to other people so they can make money. You know, this is my own guilt speaking, but that's no issue you found in your research?
It's a huge issue. Sarah, would you rate, how guilty do you feel when you leave in the morning on a 1 to 5 scale?
I'd put it about a 2. It's not that I feel guilty when I leave, but I do feel kind of sad sometimes because I know I'm going to miss her.
But you don't feel at all guilty that she bonds with you, she nurses with you, she wishes you would stay, and you're going to, you know, to some office?
Well, when you put it like that.
Your concerns about doing the right thing as a parent are so typical of every parent in America right now. She's doing great. She's doing wonderful. But most American parents are feeling uncomfortable and guilty with what they're doing with their kids, and they're trying to give them more. That kind of stress makes for long-term dissatisfaction.
Now, that was not what I was expecting to hear. See, I think of myself as mellow dad. I know all about the modern, over-anxious perfectionist parent. Who doesn't know this by now? The helicopter parent, the overindulgent parent, the hyper-competitive parent out to make the perfect child. I get it. It's crazy. Humans have done just fine without baby Einstein. I am enlightened. So I reassured Dr. Rothram that I'm not anxious about Susanna's grade point average. I'm only anxious about her being a happy kid.
That might be true, but I would challenge that.
Yeah.
You're thinking that you're happy and you're fine and whatever she does on that achievement mode is going to be okay with you.
Yeah. You're doubting it?
I don't think so.
Really? You can read anxiety in me? I'm a GPA hound waiting to happen?
I think that may be true.
I think that what you said is probably fairly insightful, because I think that while Bill might like to think that he's pretty easygoing about being a parent, that he's actually quite concerned about the example he's setting.
You reflect the culture you grew up in. And in America, individual achievement is highly, highly valued. Parents who want their kids to intellectually achieve at school have a whole set of things that they're doing. And you're doing everything that parents would do to try to do that.
You mean the fact that I'm reading to her and pointing out, letters, that kind of stuff?
Absolutely. And that she's already imitating you, touching letters and making noises. She has no idea what it is that you're trying to do with the reading. You are a person who highly valued achievement. Mm. And while right now she doesn't go to school, wait till the first time she goes out at preschool, and you're all of a sudden comparing your kid to every other preschool kid.
I don't want to be that guy. I'm going to be that guy?
I'm not sure, but I'd encourage you to have the confidence. Look at what you've done so far. A beautiful, verbal, on-track, happy kid, and still...
She was putting something in her mouth, honey. You know what that... Oh, it's food. Okay, sorry.
And still you're anxious about it.
Oh, man, that was hard to take. Well, I wanted to know what values I'm imparting to my daughter without even thinking about it. So according to one expert, anyway, I am communicating the value of self-love in many ways. However, unless I shift my attitude, I do run the risk of contradicting myself, of letting her know that she's not good enough, and it's because I'm not good enough. Fortunately, I have a happy daughter who still has plenty of time to teach me these things. This is part of a series of reports I'm doing called Bill's Values, and you can hear all of it at weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Executive MPA Program.
Later, we'll meet a man who says that bears are more huggy than they are grizzly. Coming up on Weekend America. We'll be right back. From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Desiree Cooper with Bill Radke.
It's time for your letters now. Last week, we brought you a story about hitchhiking to spring break. Some of you wrote in with your own hitchhiking memories. Julie Klosterman listens to us on Minnesota Public Radio.
Listening to your story of youthful travel via hitchhiking made me pause for just a few moments and reminisce about my own hitchhiking experiences with a college roommate in North Dakota. Having your own car was a luxury then, but needing to make it home for the weekend frequently required a thumb. One weekend, after getting stuck along the interstate in a snowstorm and then being picked up by a family with six kids in a very crowded station wagon, my roommate and I had to admit that the thrill was gone.
Also last week, we ran a story about foreclosures in the upscale gated communities in Las Vegas. Many of you took issue with a reference to pit bulls. Here's a segment from that story.
And she realized the gated community she'd moved into was changing fast.
It just wasn't what I expected.
The break-ins, which just occurred, the busted windows.
That's one of Karen's neighbors.
The mysterious neighbors across the street who don't speak and come in the middle of the night. The roommates, the broken-down cars, the pit bulls.
To understand how San Nicolo went from a place you'd expect to see golden retrievers to a place where pit bulls are the in-vogue pet, you need to back up a few years.
I talked to Dr. Stanley Corin, who studies dogs and their behavior, and I asked him if pit bulls have always had such a bad reputation.
Well, actually, the devil dogs have changed over the years. You know, back in the 20s and 30s, the devil dogs were Chow Chows. And then in the 40s, it became the German Shepherd because, you know, the evil Nazi war dog. When I was younger, the devil dogs were Dobermans. And then it was in the 80s, there were a couple of cases where some kids were savaged by pit bulls. And the pit bull then became sort of the momentary devil dog. And the reason they've held it for so long is because a lot of people who do nefarious things, you know, sell drugs and that kind of thing, decided that these were the dogs that they wanted as their guard dogs. So after a while, having a pit bull branded you. And then, like what usually happens in these instances, it then gets picked up and gets a life of its own. Mm-hmm. So, for example, just about every rapper likes to show off that he's associated with pit bulls.
Right? This is really interesting, but I'm sure that rappers didn't invent marrying social status or identity with a dog breed. How did we start linking those two up?
Well, in part it started because certain dogs were, in fact, high status. You know, way back, dogs were mostly working animals. And to have a pet animal, to have an animal which obviously was not a working animal, you had to have certain resources. Later on, what happened is that when the middle class became stronger and began to have a little bit more extra money, they decided that we would like a dog, you know, but a high-class dog. I mean, you as a middle-class merchant might not be able to point proudly to your ancestors, but, you know, if you had this purebred dog, it was as aristocratic as the king because, you know, it had pure bloodlines going back for hundreds of years. So that was one way of sort of, you know, showing off.
So are we right to assume what we assume about people based on the dogs they choose?
Well, I don't think so. You know, for a long time, poodles have been considered to be sort of a frou-frou dog, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't ask for that haircut, okay? however, people forget that Omar Bradley went all through World War II accompanied by his big black standard poodle, Bo. I mean, no, Omar Bradley is not, you know, draped out in furs and that sort of thing.
What kind of dog do you have?
My adult is a Nova Scotia duck tolling retriever, and my baby is a beagle.
Well, I can definitely say by your choice of dogs, you're a wonderful, affable human being and full of fun.
Oh, well, tell my wife that, please.
Dr. Corin, thank you for joining us.
All right, take care.
We love to get your letters and comments. Come share yourself with us at weekendamerica.org.
We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
Thanks for sharing your weekend with us. In St. Paul, I'm Desiree Cooper, along with Bill Radke, who's in Los Angeles. About 10 days ago, a 700-pound grizzly bear named Rocky killed his trainer, Stephen Miller. Rocky was the bear that you may have seen in Will Ferrell's comedy Semi-Pro. California authorities don't have any plans right now to remove Rocky from his compound or to euthanize him. Bill Killam would probably agree with that decision. For the last 16 years, he's been studying black bears in the forests of New Hampshire. He's written a book called Among the Bears. Ben's work has generated controversial claims about the way bears think, interact, and even how they communicate. Reporter Sean Hurley spent some time with Ben, Among the Bears.
Ben Killam lives with his wife in the mountains of New Hampshire, in a house he built 3 years ago. There's a small beaver pond out front, ducks in the nearby woodlands, and through the trees you can see the jagged line of a distant ridge. I'd come to hear more about his work with the black bears, and hopefully to get a glimpse of this cautious, and according to Ben, highly misunderstood animal.
Well, we could go out and try to locate Bert.
Bert is the oldest male bear that Ben watches.
I have a collar on him and been able to close on him, but we could go into the woods following his signal.
Ben tracks about 10 bears by means of telemetry radio collars. We went out in his pickup truck to see if we could triangulate Bert's position.
About halfway between where we stopped up there, just about on that angle.
So right in the middle?
Yeah, he's about the same strength signal from each end.
Ben decided to take me to Bert's den, which, based on the telemetry, was not at that moment occupied. We parked the truck and walked out together through a rising wood and then crossed over a thorny meadow. Ben gestured to a small, open cave. This was Bert's den. If I wasn't going to see a bear, I thought I might at least appreciate the inside of a bear's house.
We'll use some sticks he hauled in there. All right. And it's really wet.
And now I'm in Bert's den.
This is just where you wanted me, isn't it?
Yeah.
Down here.
Interview's over, Bert.
By closely observing the bear's life and habitat, Ben has come up with several theories. One of his more controversial ideas suggests that bears cooperate with each other.
I've watched a strange female bear come in and take food in her clearing, and she didn't attack that stranger. And the reason she didn't attack that stranger was because she needed that stranger, and she couldn't afford to alienate that stranger. And that's where the reciprocal altruism comes in.
The current scientific belief is that bears don't cooperate, that they don't share food. To support his observations, Ben would need hard data. But Ben isn't a scientist. In fact, Ben can't be a scientist, at least not in the traditional sense. He's dyslexic and reads at the level of a third grader. This puts an advanced degree in wildlife biology out of reach. Without a PhD, he can't publish his findings in scientific journals.
I was very well aware that I would be criticized as not being a good observer and not having my fancy degrees, that my observations were anecdotal and I'm using anthropomorphisms. This is all the general lingo that comes out when somebody who's not a scientist tries to do something.
The scientific community doesn't agree with what Ben's doing, but they have gradually accepted many of his ideas. Still, his in-the-field method stands in direct conflict with the standard mode of quantitative science.
My method was to observe as much as I possibly could. If I decided right then to be scientific, I would have had to come up with a hypothesis about one small, very small part of the bear's behavior and document the daylights out of that one very small part. Well, in order to do that, I would have missed everything else.
When he was 40 years old, Ben Killam took a test and learned that his IQ put him in the top 1% of the population.
At age 40, I deliberately abandoned the cultural world because it hadn't done any good for me. There was no opportunity in it for me as it existed. When I learned what my IQ was, and that really was a revelation, I said, geez, if I'm that damn smart, why can't I just do what I want to do?
It was late afternoon, and we were driving alongside the wide, glassy sprawl of the Connecticut River. I was resigned to the fact that we probably wouldn't see any bears. But Ben had one last spot he wanted to take me. We jostled up a mile-long scrap of dirt road in his old white truck, moving deeper and deeper into the forest. We were heading for a clearing of grass and clover, where Ben often meets up with Squirty, his principal bear liaison.
hierarchy goes, Squirty, then me, and then the rest of our family.
I'm way down at the bottom.
Oh, you're below the bottom.
Oh, no.
I get bit for bringing people like you in there.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ben.
When we arrived at the clearing, Squirty was nowhere to be seen. We walked around the trees and grasses for 15 minutes or so.
There she is, right there.
Where is she?
Right up on the hill. Two cubs behind her. The cubs moving now.
Oh, yeah. Wow.
Squirty and her cubs glided in a line down the ridge, glancing our way, before finally disappearing behind a knoll. Ben sent me back to the truck. He went out to meet her with a small bag of corn.
Hi, Squirty.
Now, Squirty's just come up to the main open area here and took the whole bag of corn.
Hi, guy.
From Ben's hand.
Hi, guy.
Just walking away like a shopper, a bag of food. Go off and feed the cubs.
Maybe it's because Ben has a bear-like quality himself. He's large and quiet and deliberate and watchful. But as he moves happily alongside Squirty and they head out toward the cubs, it dawns on me that he and his bears have an awful lot in common. They both live at a similar distance from the world, and who they are and what they have to offer is not easily accessible or readily available. They are both wary of man and his methods. For Weekend America, I'm Sean Hurley in New Hampshire.
Ben Killam will be spending this weekend in the grass and clover field hanging out with Squirty and her two cubs. Ben is writing a second book about his experiences with the bears, and he plans on following that up with a 10-year-long data collection study. He hopes that this is going to provide hard evidence to support all the findings of his observation-based methods.
Well, I'm sure those bears are friendly, but I do hope Ben is at least wearing some protective clothing. On the other hand, no protective clothing allowed today if you are going to truly observe World Naked Gardening Day. Yes,
uh-oh.
Gardeners around the world are marking this day. Jay North is an organic gardener in Ojai, California. He is an advocate of the gardening and the nudity. Jay, where are you right now?
We're at the community garden in downtown Ojai, and no, my clothes are not off.
Uh-huh.
This is very much a public garden directly across the street from the police department.
What can you see?
Beautiful flowers, lots of herbs coming off right now and flowering herbs. Kale, cabbage.
Why are you into naked gardening?
Well, for one thing, I'm a naturalist and I enjoy being nude in nature. So, you know, like if I go hiking up in the mountains, I go to the hot springs or out in the wilderness, I just enjoy taking my clothes off.
How is that different from covered up gardening?
I love the sun on my back. And I don't know exactly how to put it into words except to say there might be some sort of spiritual connection to it.
What about all the sunscreen between you and the earth?
I don't use it. I don't believe in sunscreen.
Oh, okay. And when you're gardening naked, what do you notice? What would I notice if I gardened naked for the first time?
I'm glad you didn't ask what you'd notice about me.
No.
Oh, good. What you might notice about yourself is you may be slightly more aware of your environment. You'll certainly be more aware of the weather, hot, cold, breezy. You might experience the joy that I and a few of my friends get by gardening in the nude.
Would I have to give up blackberries?
Just don't get too close and don't bend the wrong way. And watch what you do with the clippers. Be careful of bee stings and where they sting. That could definitely be a downside, and I have been stung.
How is it going over with your neighbors?
At first, it didn't go over well, and I have a slat fence, so you can, if you want to peer through, you can see what's going on in the backyard. And for some reason, there were two or three neighbors that weren't particularly happy about me having my clothes off in my own yard. One of them actually called the police like 13 times. They only came out 9. And then they stopped showing up because I wasn't breaking any laws.
So this woman who doesn't, the last thing she wants to do is see you naked, and she's peering through the slat fence to check on you?
How else is she going to know I'm naked?
Jay, enjoy the day. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Organic gardener Jay North speaking to us from Ojai, California, on the occasion of World Naked Gardening Day.
Well, World Naked Gardening Day is just a day, so we're looking forward now to next week when our Listening In series will continue. That's where we explore the role that music plays in people's lives. Every morning on every space shuttle mission, NASA wakes up the astronauts with a song.
some things in life are bad.
Good morning, Atlantis, and a special good morning to you, Steve.
Good morning, Sharon, and thanks very much for that little touch of Monty Python in the morning. It's easy to look at the bright side of life when you look out the window and see the earth traveling beneath us once every 90 minutes.
Always look on the bright side of life.
We'd like to hear from you. What's your perfect wake-up song? Is it different on the weekend than it is during the week? Maybe so. What songs pull you out of bed in the morning?
I'm always kind of spacey in the morning. Maybe I could use this. Well, let us know at weekinamerica.org, and we'll put together a Week in America wake-up listener playlist for next week.
Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your scene, give the audience a grin.
Turning to weather now, Friday's Mississippi Valley storms should be easing today. Here is John Moe with the look on the bright side at what Americans are doing outside this weekend.
Want to spend the weekend in a total hellhole? Jamestown, South Carolina can set you up. They host the Hellhole Swamp Festival with children's games, beauty contest, Miss Hellhole, and tobacco spitting contest. It's hot in the hellhole, 82, and thunderstorms are expected. Ample parking available, price of admission, one eternal soul. El Reno, Oklahoma loves fried onion burgers, like a lot. They hold a day-long festival for the local delicacy under sun and 73 degrees with car show, fun run, which they call the bun run, and the highlight, cooking up a 750-pound fried onion burger. It's a lot of fun, at least until a 150,000-pound Wimpy from the Popeye cartoon shows up. He's hungry, and he's offering payment on Tuesday. Thunderstorms and 81 degrees in Tuscumbia, Alabama for a Civil War reenactment weekend. Look for war skirmishes, dulcimer music, and hayrides. It's a vivid reminder of a dark time in our history when brother fought brother and listened to dulcimer music with brother, and then went with brother on a lovely hayride. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
We're going to New Orleans next for Jazz Fest and the man who almost didn't make it under the gospel tent. Stay tuned to Weekend America.
Weekend America is supported by the Fetzer Institute as part of its campaign for love and forgiveness, online at loveandforgive.org.
From American Public Media, this is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. Right now in New Orleans, the second weekend of the Jazz and Heritage Festival is in swing. Last weekend, a group called the Worship Squad had its first performance under the acclaimed gospel tent. Now, Louisiana is filled with gospel choirs, so when you get invited to the gospel tent at Jazz Fest, you have made it. Ron Hadley is the leader of the worship squad, and his personal journey to the big show has not been an easy one. Reporter Lawrence Lanahan has the minister's story.
If I had to sum up Jazz Fest in just one word, I'd have to say decadence.
Come on, there's too many people walking without a beer in their hand. You're on
people!
But just outside the main hubbub is a sanctified space, the gospel tent. This year, a young group called the Worship Squad plays the gospel tent for the first time ever. Ron Hadley is their leader. He's a 27-year-old minister. His lifelong dream has been to take his own group to the gospel tent. But the way he tells it, no one who knew him 7 or 8 years ago would have expected to see him there. As a teenager in Raceland, Louisiana, Ron Hadley was behaving badly.
At that time, the police had been to my mom's house one time looking for me.
Ron had been on probation for a juvenile offense. When he was 20 and living in Thibodaux, Louisiana, an adult charge triggered a probation violation.
I think that charge was misdemeanor theft. And my mom called and told me on the phone, hey, don't you come to Raceland. Something going on. You need to get yourself together.
A warrant was out for his arrest. Then he got his girlfriend pregnant. And at 26 weeks, complications arose.
The baby's heart rate kept dropping. It kept dropping. Kept dropping. The doctor comes in and says, if you have to have this baby now, the chances of him living are slim to none.
The heart rate continued dropping. His girlfriend went into the OR for delivery, and Ron began to bargain with God.
I began to pray, and I told him, I said, you know, God, if you bring me through this, I promise to live for you, and I'm going to be the best father I can be to my son.
Then he made the biggest decision of his life.
The baby was born on December 25th of 01, and I turned myself in on January 16th.
3 days before Gospel Tent, Ron has the worship squad gathered for rehearsal at the church where he's minister of music. There's been a mix-up with the time, and they get going a little bit late.
So what's your punishment when people are late to this rehearsal?
They don't let me punish them. They stick together.
When they finally get going...
Here we go, right on it. Ready? Sing! May have some scars,
I am here. Ron rides them really hard.
Not too many of y'all. I don't want to hear Jerry. Tanitra sang out. I'm right in front of you, and I'm not hearing you.
And by the end, they're ready for the big show.
Also, what you'll see on my wall of everything is a plaque from the Christ Baptist Church Cathedral family.
At Ron's apartment outside of New Orleans, the walls are like a scrapbook of his life. Old concert programs, religious figurines. Ron pulls down a piece of art someone from his church brought to him while he was in jail.
As you can see, it's a picture of a man holding his child. And this is very important to me because the most important thing in my life is my son. If my house was to try to catch on fire, this would be the first thing that I grab.
After being born premature, his son spent 6 months in the hospital. That whole time, Ron was in jail waiting for his court date. That, he says, is when God came to him and his life began to transform.
Well, my son, he got out on June 24th, and I got out on June 26th.
For the next year, Ron Jr. was on oxygen, but he eventually became healthy. He's 6 now. During that time, Ron Sr. got a GED and an associate's degree. He started a couple of gospel groups, but they didn't work out.
I was going through a phase where I was just sick of people playing church.
The worship squad, though, feels right to him.
They all are born again. They all are spirit-filled.
In late 2007, a Jazz Fest employee who attends Ron's church saw the worship squad.
She referred me to the lady who's in charge of booking the talent for Gospel Tent.
In January, the worship squad got the news. They were invited to take the stage on the Saturday of the festival's first weekend.
I left them at home.
Backstage at the Gospel Tent Saturday morning, things are tense.
Ryan, you know, we were really truly thinking about voting you out as the leader.
Ryan,
But just before they go on, they join hands and calmly pray.
Come on, get in the prayer circle and y'all be quiet. Bow your heads, please. Heavenly Father, we just want to thank you, Lord. We know we had a bad start this morning, Lord, my Father, being on the road, and Lord, my Father.
And then, it's showtime.
All right, I got the thumbs up. I need you to put your hands together and let them know you appreciate it. Let's go worship for a while. Come on, y'all. Give us some praise.
The first song is a little slow, but soon enough, they're absolutely cooking. Ron's next dream is to tour overseas, and this stage is where they're most likely to be discovered. But it all rides on the crowd's reaction. And by the end, Worship Squad has the front half of the packed tent on their feet. Outside the tent, as the next band gets going, there's just one audience member that Ron is worried about. Ron Jr.
You proud of me?
Yes. I'm proud of you.
For Weekend America, I'm Lawrence Lanahan in New Orleans.
I love the photos we have at our website, a slideshow of the Worship Squad at the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. Joy and fervor. Come swing on over to weekendamerica.org. Well, that's another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Glad you spent it with us. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. Remember that you can download a free podcast of the entire program. Go to weekendamerica.org. It's the weekend. Enjoy.
Weekend America is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independence in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by American Public Media.
On the next Weekend America, a new series looks back on pivotal events 40 years ago that shaped our nation and still affect us today.
I had a call from Martin Luther King. He said, this may be my last campaign, and we're going for broke.
40 years ago this weekend in 1968, Resurrection City came alive in our nation's capital. Martin Luther King's final failure on the next Weekend America. Join us.